and welcome to the Zeitgeist Tapes. My name's Emma Burnell, and I am a political journalist, and I'm joined, as always, by Steve Fielding. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Emma.
We are going to discuss something different today, but I thought we'd better start by acknowledging the biggest political upheaval of the week, which is not anything to do with Milkshake, but is in fact the ending of Game of Thrones, which we have not covered on this podcast. And Steve, do you want to tell the listeners why that is?
Well, I have to apologise, listener. I have never seen Game of Thrones. And so I thought that might be some kind of impediment to discussing it. Although, being on Twitter, I feel like I have seen the last season. And to be perfectly honest, I'm completely sceptical, as in, it could be great, and lots of people obviously think it's great, and I'm sure Emma will jump in and tell me how great it is. And I understand it's very interesting, but I don't have Sky, and I have no intention of getting Sky. And it's 8 seasons or 8 years of a thing, and I think my life is too short.
Well, I mean, I think, given that your speciality is how politics and popular culture meet, it's an odd one for you not to have watched, because it is very, very political. Mm. But I absolutely agree that starting now would be an incredibly daunting prospect. Mm. I mean, even in the last series, which was a very short series, each episode was an hour and a half long, feature length episodes. So there is an awful lot to it. But it is, I think, it has been a really interesting exploration. Now, the ending I didn't have much time for, but it has been an exploration about the different ways in which power works. And sometimes that works through might and people having lots and lots of armies and dragons and not being able to be killed and all sorts of things like that. But quite a lot of the times it does happen through politicking. And some of the most successful characters in Game of Thrones were not the best fighters, but the best politicians. And the ones who made it all the way from the first episode to the last were definitely those ones. So I think it's been a really, really interesting way for people to look at and talk about, in a popular culture venue, how power works and explore that and examine it. And I think genuinely it does have a lot to say about that narrative. So maybe one day when you're old and grey, Steve.
I am old and grey, Emma. I am old and grey. But no, I totally get the point you're making about power. And at least one of my students has written about Game of Thrones, about how it depicts politics and things like that. And apparently Battlestar Galactica was also a similar thing about power.
So I hear, which I haven't watched.
Well, I haven't watched it either, but apparently that was quite good. So yeah, I mean, I totally get what you're saying. But you could say there is other things, like, I don't know, EastEnders, beloved Emmerdale Farm, that they explore power in different ways, and we should be aware of what those things are saying to their viewers, because I think insidiously it does have an influence. But yeah, when I'm even older and even greyer than I am already, just before Alzheimer's really hits, I'll bear your kind words in mind.
When I'll give you the warning that my friend gave me. She said, if you can get past all the tits, there's great politics in it. And the first couple of series, it is quite hard to get past all the tits.
But, well, I'm not saying anything in relation to that. To that
Maybe
comment.
You're going to go watch it now.
All I know is that my mum liked it, I think she got past the tits.
But we're not here to want to talk about Game of Thrones. I'm now just completely lost. What we are going to discuss today, and we were originally planning this because we believed that we would now be gloriously independent Britain. Rah. Plucky little Britain, separated from our nearest and dearest neighbours on the continent, which is why we planned to watch Passport to Pimlico, which is an Ealing, is it comedy? I wouldn't say it's an Ealing comedy. It's an Ealing film.
It's normally seen as a comedy. I mean, Didn't you think it was funny?
Oh, it definitely had funny moments. Don't get me wrong. Oh, right. There was definitely funny stuff in it, but right. It also had some quite serious stuff. So it was one of those kind of like, is it a comedy drama or that kind of thing? And I guess that's a more modern split that you wouldn't necessarily have had when it was first marketed.
No, I think it was definitely a comedy, defined as a comedy in its day.
So yeah, Passport to Pimlico, Steve. Tell us all about it.
Well, Passport to Pimlico... was released, I think it was 1949, so during the Attlee government that was doing all those things that many people think were very good and others less so sure about. And it's about a part of Pimlico in London's south, which at the time is quite working class, presented as being a bit socially mixed, but it's predominantly an ordinary place where ordinary people live. And they're living under rationing because after the Second World War, there were lots of food shortages, just as there had been during the war. So people weren't allowed to buy beyond certain amounts of bread, you know, certain kinds of food and clothes and other things. So everything was quite regulated. So there were fair shares for everybody. But the film starts with this community kind of being very a bit fed up about rationing, and it was a bit of black market stuff, and then there's an explosion. An unexploded bomb explodes, which exposes a great big hole in the ground in which there's lots of treasure, which they all like, and also documents which prove that that area of Pimlico is actually part of Burgundy. And subject to the rule of the Duke of Burgundy and any of his descendants. So they're not actually part of Britain. And so they're not subject to all this rationing. So they've got all this freedom that they hadn't got before. And, you know, they go through all these kind of waves of this is great. Or maybe it's not so great because all these spivs and people that want to take advantage of all this market freedom flood into the area. Most of them are criminals. And then the British government steps in and says, well, we want to have that treasure, and they don't want to give the treasure away. And so the British government imposes a siege. And so it's actually a film, which is, I mean, that I won't, shall I spoil the end? Or shall we work
all the
way
through?
Yeah, I
think we generally we're okay with spoilers when discussing things we're discussing.
So it turns into a battle between the British state and regulation and the desire of the residents of Pimlico to be free of all of this. And in the end, despite the siege and lots of conflict and bureaucracy and civil servants trying to get the people to do what they're told, there is a reconciliation that the people give away part of their freedom. They take back their ration books, but they share the bounty that is from all of this treasure. So it's kind of a happy ending. And you know, in terms of all the plot that I've just gone into, it might sound a bit fantastic and a bit silly, but it's actually, as Emma was suggesting, it's meant to be a comedy, but it does have some serious, potentially serious issues. And I think one reason why we thought it'd be a good idea to talk about this film, even though it's, you know, from the 1940s, a totally different era, that it actually does raise various sort of interesting questions about us today. Don't you think, Emma?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were some really interesting parallels and some really interesting differences in both attitudes to the state. There was, there's this whole sort of endless sort of thing about the end of deference in the 1960s, and deference died in the 1960s. But actually, if you look at the way that they, the second they get freed from state control, they go mental. And have just huge parties, and they're just drinking all night, and they're very, very happy, and it's all, you know, bollocks to you lot.
Not literally. It's a 1940s film. Nobody says that.
Call blimey governor to you lot. I mean, some of the accents are ropey as hell. But on the other hand, they then get very much the hangover, and, you know, there's a really strong anti-free market message in there in terms of, you know, the black market just immediately, as soon as there's no regulation, the black market takes over. And it's a complete nightmare for everybody. So, yeah, it's a really interesting kind of balance of you don't want this overweening state telling you when you can go out and when you can stay in. But at the same time, you do need some support mechanisms. And you need some of the things that the state does on a collective level in order to give you individual freedom. And even when you had these bureaucrats from Whitehall who are pretty much the bad guys, but even they aren't completely 100% the bad guys. So I noticed that there's a point at which, so they cut them off from water, during which they are very much the bad guys. And then they go and they manage to sneak out and restart the hydrant and refill their water. But by doing so, they flood their own food supplies. And the Whitehall people are about to see them, you know, starved out. And they say, well, we can't starve them. We've got to go and, you know, can someone get you? Was it the United Nations, I think, or the precursor to the United Nations, to go and help them out? And just as they're about to do that, they ring up and capitulate. And they're about to leave when the generosity of the crowd means that they are still crowd outside who are very supportive of the plucky little Burgundians, as they call themselves. They then feed them and they give them lots of food and they keep donating food to them so that they can then live happily and comfortably for quite some time. And yeah, you know, and they have to negotiate with the states about the various sort of different things. So, for example, the tube runs underneath, and as they get told that they can't go out to wider Britain, then they say, "Well, okay, you can't come under," and they stop the tube and have customs searches and things.
Yes.
So it's a really interesting example of kind of the limits of, but the necessity of, bureaucracies.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of Ealing was famous, the Ealing studios was famous for this kind of shtick, really. There were things like Whiskey Galore, Titfill Thunderbolt. I mean, these are film historians would all be very familiar with all of this, but I mean, you'd heard of the film, but you'd never seen the film. Is that right?
That's right. I'd definitely heard of it, but I hadn't. It was one of those ones that was always on the list and then never got around to. So I'm very, very glad that we decided to do it because it's a lovely film.
Yeah. And it's, it was one of a number of films which was about a little community faced with the imposition of authority and the battle between the two. And these were films that were being made, well, actually from the late 30s, but particularly into the 40s, and then they petered out in the 1950s, early 50s. And there were lots of other sort of studios doing similar kinds of things. So it was a very popular way of presenting a drama, you know, a community against authority. But I think it was particularly acute and particularly pertinent in the 40s, because that was a time when the Labour government was expanding government and the state. And also there'd been wartime regulation of a massive sort in a unique way. So it did raise these questions about, well, how good is this for us? You know, if the Labour government is doing all these things in the name of making society fairer and more equal and maybe more efficient, then but we kind of resent some of this. So where's the boundary? What's it all about? And I think the film did explore those kinds of issues in an interesting way, and obviously it went on the it was politically biased. It was in favour generally of the Labour government, what it was doing, the filmmakers were, so that's, it kind of ended with a reconciliation that everybody could gain from it, and that was their message. This is something from which everybody can gain.
Yeah, absolutely. And now remind me, I watched it the other night. The ending, it felt quite abrupt, the ending. It's sort of all of a sudden they've all decided to live together happily, and it kind of, I don't know. Whereas everything else, they took quite a long time over. You know, is the Duke of Burgundy the Duke of Burgundy? And then I think he actually was the Duke of Burgundy, and he didn't.
Oh no, he was.
I thought he was going to turn out to be a complete chancer.
No, he wasn't the villain, was he?
And my innate anti-French bias there. but yeah, he just turned out to be quite a nice, sweet guy, and there to be a bit of romance.
Yes, with Barbara Murray. Yes.
Yes. And there was some. I mean, she was a very interesting character. because she was sort of half Dolly Bird, half feminist, as far as I can tell. Maybe I'm putting too much of a modern spin on her.
Well, she's the daughter of the shopkeeper, who's basically kind of like the leader of the Pimlico people, isn't she?
Yeah.
I mean, she's an independent. She's independent. She's got two suitors. She decides the one that she wants. I don't know beyond that how much of a feminist she was.
I think it was more that she was perfectly willing to stand up for herself.
Oh yeah.
And to fight for politically for the things her dad wanted too. Like she was on the side of the building the Lido, which was the big.
Oh yeah. Yeah, she was glamorous, but she had her own mind. Yeah.
And there were lots of sort of different characters in it, some of whom were more sympathetic than others. But I think the shopkeeper is definitely the sort of main protagonist that we're supposed to care about. And he starts off being quite clear. You know, he's trying to get the council, instead of selling off the land to developers, to build a public space for kids.
Yeah, something for the community.
Something for the community. So this is, it's quite a relevant debate to now.
Yeah.
They're living in times of austerity. The council are trying to raise money other ways, but he wants to invest something in the longer term. And he has these lovely plans for a park and a Lido. And eventually he gets his way, largely by declaring himself independent.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I don't know, because obviously austerity, when first austerity was a thing in this country, lots of people started looking at this period and looking for echoes. It's a very different kind of austerity, the 1940s. It was something that everybody endured. I mean, you have rationed, everything's rationed.
They were all in it together.
They were all in it together, yeah. But it is interesting that you're absolutely right. You know, there is this vacant ground, which I think by courtesy of German bombing, there's this big empty space in Pimlico. And there is a debate about how should we use it? Should we use it for the good of the community or to make money and to sell it off? And that's because we haven't got enough money to really, we need money. So if only, contemporary councils today could have some unexploded bombs revealing all kinds of treasure, that would be our problem
that
solved.
That would be ideal for most councils, yes.
That would be ideal for us. But I think there was another reason why I think we thought it might be interesting. It's because, it raises issues about Englishness. And I think it's more Englishness than Scottish or Welshness. I mean, I don't think if you said Britain, I don't think that would really work for Passport to Pimlico. But there's a really good scene in the film, which the wife of the shopkeeper articulates the kind of ethos of the Pimlico people. Because if we could show that or play that clip, and it's when one of the two Whitehall mandarins comes basically to lay it on the line and say you've got to give up. And then there's a discussion, which, like I say, reveals the ethos about what it is to be English.
Should we have a listen to that now?
Why not?
Well, I'm really glad. Of course, I always knew you people had to recognise us sooner or later. Oh, here is the Duke.
Ah, Your Excellency. Allow me to present my credentials.
But I'm not the ruler, though. Mm-hmm. No, they've asked me to form a cabinet.
Oh, long live democracy.
Vive l'Angleterre.
Vive la France.
What next?
Well, you will understand that after today's incident on the underground, His Majesty's government does not feel inclined to negotiate with a pistol at his head.
Now that we've come down to brass tacks, I can guarantee that we
His Majesty's further... government has a traditional dislike of unilateral guarantees. It has therefore felt itself compelled, most reluctantly, to close the frontier as from 10 a.m. tomorrow.
Close the frontier? What about us?
A church hall has been equipped for the evacuation of all those who...
Church hall?
Evacuation? What about our treasure?
Well, for the time being, that can be moved to the Bank of England.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm not moving anyway.
I beg your pardon?
If the Nazis couldn't drive me out of my home with all their bombs and rockets and doodlebugs, you don't catch me packing up now.
I trust you realize that the alternative is complete isolation.
Power politics, eh?
I have merely explained the position. I cannot do more. I do hope that moderation will prevail.
Moderation? He's an optimist. You're farming, a lot of you. We've had a good run, and this is it.
That's okay, Jim. If you want to turn it in, no one's going to stop you.
We're not going to stand for that. You can't push English people around like sacks of potatoes.
English?
Don't you come that stuff, Jim Garland. We always were English and we always will be English. And it's just because we are English that we're sticking out for our right to be Burgundians.
Yeah, right.
So there's a kind of paradox in the film that, you know, they want to be Burgundians because they're English. They want the right to be free and to have this identity and not to be told what to do, which means they've got to be Burgundians because they're English, and they're not going to take it. Like they didn't take it during the war from Hitler. They're not going to take it from Whitehall, which is kind of, it sounds a bit familiar, some of that maybe.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely take back control. I think that you can see how Leavers could definitely take this film, you know, much as, you know, we've talked about how it's sympathetic to the Attlee government, to collectivism. It's also sympathetic to that kind of nostalgic Leave sense of Britain, sense of Englishness. That, as you say, the Leave vote capitalised on quite considerably.
And given that, I'm coming at it, and my interpretation of it is through having read a lot of film historians and people that write about the Labour government. Because whenever people write about the Labour government and stray into the era of popular culture, they always mention Passport to Pimlico. And the interpretation is, well, it's quite progressive, really, and it's, you know, making a case for the government and this and that. But I am sure there's, like you're saying, I'm sure there would be people of a different disposition who would go, this shows how terrible, you know, the tyranny of Whitehall is, and people want to be free. And they're into, it would be interesting to have Nigel Farage watch that film or someone of that ilk and see what they thought about it. Because they may be able to take something from it. And it kind of just shows that, you know, English identity or expressions of English identity can be taken in different ways, like the whole debate about Leave and Remain is today. I mean, it's what is it to be English, not only within the United Kingdom, but within Europe?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I know that some libertarians really take the film to heart. You know, look how well they can do without government. Maybe they weren't watching the ending so much, but
no.
That's definitely been, you know, the middle bit, well, not the middle, the Burgundians go up and down in terms of their fortunes. And I think what's interesting is it's not when they're at their lowest ebb that they decide that everything's wrong and they should leave and give it all up. It's actually once they've come back from that a bit, but they then need to kind of think about the longer term, that they decide their longer term future is with their nearest and bit larger and richer neighbours. Funny that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, because they have that moment of euphoria when they, oh, we're free of controls. All right. And they're all ripping up their ration books and they're all drinking after hours as well, because drinking isn't regulated, nor is betting as well, street betting. And then almost immediately, then it's flooded with the spivs and the criminal elements, and then they go, "What's? Well, maybe there's something wrong here. Maybe we need a bit of protection."
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are probably libertarian arguments to be taken from the film, but there are also very collective arguments. And maybe it's one of those films like a Nigel Farage interview where everyone sees a different version of it, even though they're watching the same thing.
Or Jeremy Corbyn interview about Brexit. Yes.
What, constructive ambiguity?
Yes, yes. So, so it's kind of, it is ultimately, I think, a film about what it is to be English. But also, what do you do with the Second World War? Because this film was made only a few years after the Second World War. Pimlico, you can see the damage that the German bombing has done and the job of work that's got to be done to reconstruct the place.
It's so funny for me thinking of Pimlico as this poor, deprived area.
It's. I mean, I understand it's quite spanky now. Swanky, not spanky.
Yeah, it's basically like where you can, like, you've got Chelsea on one side and Westminster on the other side.
Right.
You know, you ain't going to get many properties in Pimlico below £1 million.
Well, I wonder if, because I was thinking, when you're watching the film, I mean, I must have seen it like 10 times or something. I mean, partly for work, as much as anything else. So, but I was thinking when I was watching it for this, I wonder, I mean, a remake would be interesting. It would be a bad idea. I think it would be basically a bad idea because I'm not sure how you could improve on it. But if you kind of had it set today with a similar plot, how it would be presented. And if it was going to be in Pimlico, of course, it'd all be posh. All these merchant bankers and BBC executives, that might be interesting.
And I think if you wanted to do it today, you'd have to do it in somewhere, not London, I think, to have that sense of the otherness question. I think somewhere where there's somewhere on the HS2, maybe, where they could then charge people on the HS2 to come through. To replay that scene. So, yeah, so, I don't know, somewhere like Maidenhead, maybe?
Or Stoke, somewhere near Stoke. Is that on the HS2 route? That must be. Or anyway. Yeah.
But, yeah, somewhere where there's that small... that, you know, because the current dichotomy isn't between the rich and poor living in close quarters. It's the metropolitan liberals and the smaller towns and villages, non-liberals, just not seeing each other at all. And so I think that that's where, you know, this film loses its ability to parallel current times. And why should it? But, you know, in terms of what we're looking at, it has, you know, a very different set of challenges. A lot of the same root causes, you know, austerity, people feeling like there's us and them, people trying to find, as I say, the limits of what bureaucracy is necessary and important and what bureaucracy is unnecessary and imposive. But we just don't, I think that the differences in the people don't quite work in these terms in the same way at the moment.
And I wonder, I mean, if it was done today, whether, you know, central authority would be presented in the relatively benign terms that it was in that film. That a screenwriter, you know, somebody writing it now would probably feel they've got to create government as being the real enemy, the real out of touch thing. Because although the two leading civil servants, so they're played by these comedy actors who were a bit of a double act in films called Norton and Wayne. They're obviously posh. They're obviously somewhat out of touch. They live in a different world, but they're not malign. They're kind of benign. They want to get this thing done. They want to get this problem sorted out because there's a part of London that's now no longer in Britain. So they want to get this problem sorted. But they you know, they're not evil. They don't want to really punish these people. They just want to solve the problem. Yeah, which.
And yeah, and they, you know, they've done no Burgundian planning. That's the problem.
So I suspect a screenwriter today would be, whether they wanted to consciously or not, it would turn out to be some kind of a populist perspective, and government would inevitably have to be the dark and evil force, or it'd be painted much more in those terms, which would go against the grain.
I mean, in terms of the film, who do you think were the bad guys, if there was such a thing?
Well, I would say it was like the Spivs, who all came in the immediate aftermath of freedom. I mean, they were they were described as being, you know, it's like Dartmoor, you know, coming out or something. You know, they are criminals.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they are selling goods, you know, that aren't, you know, what was it? They were like saying they were French fish, or and they weren't actually just home watered fish. You know, they were basically they were kind of conning the consumer. So yeah, I think they're the only villains of the piece.
No, I agree with that, and I do think in some ways, again, that belies the slight politics of the film in terms of it is the rampant capitalism that is the problem. I would say also there was the issue between the central bank and the local bank.
Oh yes, that was interesting.
Which has definitely been an ongoing tension for many, many years. Yes. My grandfather, who you know, was very similar in some ways to the bank manager in Passports Pimlico. He was a, you know, working class lad, worked his way up through the bank. Never went to university, anything like that. My dad was the first to go to university. And But he, you know, he originally had, you know, all of the autonomy that bank managers had. And then that just got eroded and eroded and eroded down to the computer says no culture that we have now. And it's, you know, bank manager used to be such a position in the community. And you can just see what's fascinating about this film is none of that's happened yet. And yet in that tension between the central manager and that guy, you can see that path just laid out before you. And I thought that was really interesting.
No, that is interesting. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. That's really good. But also the more generally, the community of that part of Pimlico was a community. I mean, there was not only that bank, but I mean, there was a general store, as you would expect, the pub, as you would expect, but also a little clothing shop, fishmongers. It was a situation of lots of little small business people, none of whom was particularly rich, but sort of lower middle class, upper working class, and there was a kind of rough and ready. Everyone was getting along. I know this will be an idealized presentation, but like the police officer knew about the illegal off, you know, street gambling, but there was kind of had a modus vivendi, and everyone was getting on with everybody else. So it was kind of a little bit idealized, but that's gone. I mean, there'd be a Starbucks and there'd be a huge Tesco somewhere a few miles away, and that'd be kind of it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. It's similar to the bank thing, isn't it? The supermarkets that we now just are a complete norm just weren't there. All the big things that have made capitalism different now from what it was then. So when their vision of a threatening capitalism was lots and lots of individuals breaking the rules, whereas actually what turned out to be the problem was, well, lots of individuals breaking the rules, but doing so through these massive corporate umbrellas.
Mm. And I guess, like, if Nigel Farage or Anne Widdecombe or whoever watched the film, that would be something they might go, oh, that's something we can go back to, lots of entrepreneurial, small little business people. And yet, you know, this isn't about Brexit, but, you know, there'd be lots of chlorinated chicken thrown into that if, you know.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing. You had your establishment small businesses that were already there and had shop fronts and overheads and all those things. And it was the people who came in and tried to undercut them that were the problem.
Yes.
The deregulated market.
So, you know, it's obviously evoking that time in a slightly idealized way. I think it certainly does have kind of interesting lessons or things to think about in relation to today. But that world, I mean, I don't know how long Jeremy Corbyn government would have to be in office for that world to come back. But I don't think it's ever coming back.
No, and I think there were very specific reasons why that world was that world. And it was the post-war, The things that people understood about life just after and during the war were very different from things that we understand now, because they've been through something so traumatic that we just can't even imagine it.
Yeah.
And that generation, very few of them are still with us. It's actually the generation after them that are the baby boomers that messed everything up. And I do say this to my parents regularly. My dad was actually born in 1949, so there you go.
Right.
But so I think I think there's a lot to be celebrated in this film, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned from it. But what's interesting is I think that it is a film that is almost universal, and that everybody can take the message out of it that they may want to take. So this will be coming out the Saturday after the European elections. We won't yet know the results, I don't think, although there'll be furious speculation, as always, on social and proper media. I think that whatever comes out of it, I think we can probably say that somebody somewhere will be talking about passports. But we have been delighted to be talking about passports at Pimlico.
Who knows? They may be introduced at some later date, depending on who becomes the government, you know?
Yes. Great. Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Steve, as always.
Thank you.
And this just leaves me to say thank you very much to Stuart Wood for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human Production.